If there's one mineral you should be worried about not getting enough of course, it is magnesium. You've heard me talk about it. The body's master mineral with over 300 critical reactions, including detoxification, fat metabolism, energy, even digestion, is all influenced by magnesium. I remember when I was doing endocrine rotations, my fellow used to pound on us about magnesium and their problems, two big problems. Magnesium has been largely missing from the U.S. soil since the 1950s, which explains why it's estimated that up to 80% of the population may be deficient. And also, most supplements contain only one or two forms of magnesium, when in reality there are seven that your body needs to benefit from. If you take that latter fact into consideration, is it not logical to conclude that 99% of the population is likely deficient in two or more of the essential forms of magnesium? Good news is that when you do get all seven forms of magnesium, pretty much every function, it gets upgraded, from your brain to your sleep. Pain and inflammation even could be affected. It's all improving, and it improves fast. That's why I'm excited about what my friends over at BioOptimizers, makers of industry-leading digestive supplements, have just created. The research team has recently formulated the ultimate magnesium supplement with all seven forms of the mineral. They even include trace amounts of something called monoatomic magnesium, which helps make all the other forms more bioavailable. This is the most complete magnesium product ever created, and until or unless someone comes out with a better one, I suggest you give this a try. BioOptimizers calls the product Magnesium Breakthrough, and they're running a special promotion for our listeners at BioOptimizers.com/Drew. That is BioOptimizers.com/DREW. You get an additional 10% off the normal package price with coupon code DRDREW. With this simple one action, you can reverse magnesium deficiency in all its forms and upgrade the performance of your body and possibly even how you look and feel. The Magnesium Breakthrough promotion is only while quantities last at buyoptimizers.com/Drew. That is buyoptimizers.com/DREW. And make sure you use the coupon code DRDREW to get 10% off your order. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Keep the winds in the sail, that old Corolla pirate ship. Support the people that support us. We really do appreciate it. And don't forget to head over to drdrew.com. We've got a bunch of stuff going on there now. I do a stream pretty much every day. If you sign up at drdrew.tv, you get a blast when we go out with it, at least when we're in our studio there. We literally try to, wherever we go, try to do one of those streams. And we've got some interesting guests coming in there, people like Kelly Victory and Dr. Samadi, and just interesting folk. Dennis Quaid, I think, is coming on that very soon. And, of course, over at your mom's house, the After Dark, don't forget that. We will see you all there. Do sign up for these things. And at drdrew.com, sign up in the contact list. We appreciate that. Today's guest, Aaron Tyler. The book is The Bad One, a memoir about growing up a goat and not the good kind. It's available anywhere you get books. Aaron's story of being scapegoated as a child. And I really am interested in just the topic of scapegoating generally. You can follow Aaron at Aaron Tyler, E-R-I-N, Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R, design.com. Twitter is at BunnyBlog, and then Instagram at Aaron underscore Lee, L-E-I-G-H underscore Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So scapegoating, you know, every family has a scapegoat. Well, not every family. Let me put it this way. Alcoholic families have a scapegoat. Am I onto something here?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, sometimes when parents grow up in an alcoholic family and they choose not to drink, you know, that alcoholism ends up being a trauma that gets worked out on the next generation of kids. And that's kind of what happened with me, especially with my mother's side of the family.
So she's where the gene comes in, right?
Mm-hmm. She would be where the gene comes in, probably a little bit on my dad's side too. But this is definitely a story of alcoholism.
Well, if you've got alcoholism in the family, you either get the gene or you marry one. That's kind of how it works. If you don't get the gene, then you marry an alcoholic.
Yeah. Well, that might be what happened there. But there's certainly a gene in my mom's side for sure.
And so when did you – tell us what – kind of give us a sketch of what happened and when you became aware it was scapegoating.
I was aware at a very young age, and I was extremely confused because I was being, you know, just gaslit into this false narrative that I was bad and I was burdensome and I was all of these negative things. Even though, you know, I would leave the house and I would go out and I would get straight A's and no detentions and everybody loved me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, there was this massive level of confusion always with my parents. And, you know, I would have these feelings of you know, being so invisible and so angry at times, and like all of these feelings, and anything that I felt that was not useful, mm-hmm. I was told was a selfish feeling, and I was not allowed to feel it. And you know, it didn't seem to, there was never any logic to my personhood. I was always told I was bad, 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 bad. Even when I did good things. And so I was just intensely confused all the time. Who am I? Am I this bad person, or, you know, am I, you know, just a person?
Did your family have other roles? Was there a hero and a mascot and all those usual alcoholic family member roles?
There was a golden child for
the
sure.
The hero, yeah.
Mm. Yes, there was a golden child. My sister could do no wrong. Uh-huh. And of course, she was, you know, just kind of like a replica of my mother. So,
that suggests also that there, which is often in alcoholic families, a moderate amount of narcissism there on part of your mom, which again, she had alcoholic family members. She got injured in childhood herself. So there's and alcoholics tend to have a lot of narcissistic stuff. But with the narcissist, you're either all in or all out. And for some yes. reason, you weren't reflecting back to your mom her idealized needs of being all in. And the sister got that early, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And that was the problem. It was either be the extension, make mom feel good about mom, mm-hmm. or, you know, you're out. You're out. And I was definitely out.
Again, just curious, did you end up having relationships, at least early in life, where you were trying to make a narcissist happy?
I mean, those were my only relationships, right, you know, leaving this household. I always had narcissistic boyfriends. They always withheld affection.
Jesus, always. Aaron.
You know, it was
you should write a book. You should write a book about this.
I know. It's almost like you wrote like the best book ever about narcissism. And thank you for that, by the way, because I read that book and it was so incredibly helpful when I was piecing together what happened in my primary years. I was like, well, Dr. Drew, it's almost like he saw my family.
Yeah. They're pretty common now. Totally now we're living out the latter stages of everybody being narcissistic. Adam and I always talk about how all roads lead to narcissism. For pointed anything that's going on in our society, and boom, there it is.
Oh my God! It's the underlying cause of everything.
Yep. Yes, yeah. Ma'am. Yes,
it
ma'am.
Is, it is so frustrating and upsetting to see. But yeah, I definitely recreated and recreated with therapists, with boyfriends, with friendships.
Therapists, tell me about this.
Therapist, yes. There's a really great story from this book about how I finally pieced together what my, you know, mother and father were really kind of up to, and that I got into a relationship with an extraordinarily narcissistic therapist who, in, you know, under the guise of trying to help me, tried to control me and get me to write a book about her.
Oh my God. Did you report her to the state, please?
Yes. Well, I mean, I basically just cut the cord there. And that was a little bit scary. There were some very, very scary, I would say probably a narcissistic injury on her part. A lot of really, really creepy behavior, but I managed to get away from her and I'm fine.
Should we say this woman's name?
Oh, goodness, no.
Well, I want people to not go to her. What city was this in?
This was in Arizona. I don't even want to say.
All right,
the
so
city.
Just be on your alert if you're seeing a therapist in Arizona and the boundaries yes. don't seem good, or it seems like your needs are secondary to the therapist.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Oh my God! And so you're out. You're the scapegoat. Let's talk about scapegoating generally before we get into how you recovered. What is your sort of construct on scapegoating?
You know, I think that scapegoating is a way for traumatized people to work out anything that is negative, they don't want to feel.
Projection.
And they don't want to believe about themselves. And I think it's a way for a family like mine, an alcoholic family, to stay whole. I think right. there has to be this other that they lay the sins upon and they send it out into the desert. And, right. you know, I've certainly seen it generationally.
Yeah.
I definitely saw scapegoating in my, you know, in the previous generation and maybe even before that. You know, there always seems to be one person that just can't get it right, can't get it together, and that everybody just beats up on. And I think this is a way that a lot of these families, these dysfunctional families, kind of work out their stuff in a way that leaves them all feeling safe about the reputation of the family.
And so societies do this too, right? And so Aztecs would kill somebody every morning as a scapegoat, and everyone would gather together, and whatever aggressions they had towards one another would get focused on the one whose heart they pulled out and threw down the stairs. And sort of the more traumatized somebody is, the more the intensity of the scapegoating, the more violent the scapegoating, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the sacrifice tends to be the empathic kid who is saying, hey, there's something not quite right about this tribe or this family.
That's right. Well, now you're out. Now you're out.
Yeah.
You're on the outside.
The one who sort of speaks up and says, hey, maybe we need therapy. That ends up being, you know, identified the scapegoat.
So how did that happen for you? How did you start realizing you where you were and what you needed to do, or how did that come to be?
I did not realize until quite late. I was naturally very empathic, and I just got on the story and colluded with them. And I actually became so depressed and so suicidal that I attempted suicide in 1998. I was 21 years old. I was in college, and I attempted suicide. And obviously that was a failure, thank God.
What year of college was that?
That would be my junior year of college.
And where were you at the time?
I was at Rochester Institute of Technology.
Wow.
Studying graphic design. Yeah, I mean, it should have been, you know, the best year of my life, but I was suicidal. I just could not live with this negative narrative any longer. Mm-hmm. And 8 months later, my uncle, who I believe was probably the scapegoat child of my father's family, mm-hmm. Actually did commit suicide. Wow. At the age of 42. And it was while sitting at his funeral and looking at that coffin and thinking that that could have been me, or that will be me soon, that I had these first kind of, you know, unsanctioned thoughts of like, maybe I'm right. Maybe these feelings of anger that, you know, and these thoughts that I'm not bad. Maybe this family is just a mess. Maybe those things are correct. And so, you know, what I did is I began a daily practice of writing, and I would just write down anything that came up that felt, you know, foreign or naughty or unsanctioned or, you know, but made me feel good. And that radically altered the trajectory of my life.
Tell me more. Where'd you go next?
I kind of, you know, I mean, I bounced around and I just did a lot of writing. You know, it was my daily practice every day to get up and write and really examine who I was as a person. Had a lot of, again, recreations of those formative relationships, bad boyfriends, bad breakups, things like that.
Mm. Talk about that more, about that a little bit, because, you know, so many people that are caught in these cycles of one, you know, this guy wasn't supposed to be like the other ones and he turned out to be, and blah, 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 blah. You know, the patterns that people get into, which are really ultimately broken pickers, right? They can't, they're attracted to the wrong kind of people. And that's just, people don't often think about or understand how attractions work. And you're attracted to the unfinished business of your childhood or the trauma from your childhood.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a way of working out that trauma. Here, to put it very bluntly, I dated Tucker Max for a year in 2003.
What is the matter with you, Aaron? My God. That was before he went into analysis. It says it all.
I did. He was basically a chupacabra back then. I dated him for like a year. We're good friends now.
I've been around Tucker forever. I love him. And he's got a quote on the back of the book. One of the best books I've ever read by one of the best writers of her generation. Thank you, Tucker. So there you go. Things are cool now. But he had a massive transformation. Just it was interesting. You know, narcissists normally don't get better. And he did.
Yeah, he busted his butt for it, let me tell you.
Yeah.
A lot of tears, a lot of hard work, and he should be very proud of himself.
Yeah, his dropping into analysis with tremendous speed, and then I haven't talked to him in a long time, but I'm sure it slowed down after that. But boy, he was in it and willing very quickly, which is unusual.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were a lot of good qualities to him, but you know, in the time that I was dating him, he could not have been a worse person. He was really, really awful. And I was drawn to him for all the wrong reasons. And, you know, I mean, he was a recreation, you know, the control and the, you know, I mean, he was very engaged in that cycle where they love bomb. And, you know, and they draw you in and then they push you away and they devalue you and then push you away. Just the classic, classic narcissistic features. And, you know, I mean, I just didn't really understand. I mean, because, you know, the narrative constantly was, we're a perfect family. We're a perfect family.
Yeah.
You, the external, you are the problem of this family. So I always felt sort of blind with regard to my primary relationships because, you know, to me, they just brought me so much anger, but I was not allowed to have that anger or feel that anger. And I was not allowed to examine who those people really were.
Did anybody else in the family get well, or did you getting well cause you to be completely out for good?
Oh, I'm out.
Oh,
I'm out. For sure. Sure.
Too bad your mom didn't go. Your mom okay now, or is she getting sicker?
You know, she gets better every year. And I do think this is very unconscious for her. I don't think that she's very in touch with her aggression.
Oh, of course not. People don't do this with ill in their heart, even though it comes out that way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So let's go back to you're dating Tucker Max, the Tucker Maxes of the world. You're going to therapy. Are you going to therapy while you're dating these guys?
I was not. No, I was not in therapy. Too much turmoil. And I think, you know, I mean, I thought that I could just write and that would be enough. And really has not been enough over the
right.
You know, I'm a big believer in talk therapy.
Oh, my God. You need that other brain metabolizing things for you. We just don't access things by ourselves. We just don't. And once we, you know, have access in the context of a safe holding relationship, then we need that person to metabolize it, reflect it, hand it back to us in a sort of a new reflection.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, building trust with people like that has been quite the adventure.
I'm dying to know more about the fucked up therapist. Can you go a little more into it? Because maybe we can tell people, you know, cautionary tale, what to watch out for.
Yeah. I didn't see her coming because she was extremely manipulative. You know, I mean, I'm not a clinician, but it seems to me like she definitely had borderline personality disorder or something like that.
Yeah, perfect.
A lot of fantasy, a lot of manipulation. It was either I was the best patient ever or I was the devil.
Oh, my God.
She would, you know, if I wasn't doing what she wanted me to do, she would diagnose me with things that I knew I didn't have.
Oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
What were the letters after her? What were the letters after her name?
She was a PhD.
Sheesh. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. She was a PhD. She was very scary. Ugh. For sure.
How long were you there?
I just stopped coming to therapy and she started calling all of my friends whose names I had mentioned in session, which is just so incredibly unethical and illegal. And
why didn't you report that, you know what I mean? That's such a massive HIPAA violation. You at least do that.
Yeah. Though she should not have a license to practice. I'm just absolutely terrified of her. Mm. She called all my friends and told them that I was on drugs and that they found my car in the desert with blood in it, but I was gone. And really, I was just at a friend's house. And so they all just started calling me and they're like, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm just at a friend's house. We're going to go watch a movie.
Wow. You need to report this because God knows what she's going to do to somebody else. I mean, I don't want it to cause you any harm, but my goodness, right? And I think most states allow you to do anonymous reports. But then, of course, she'll know.
I did not know that.
Wonderful. But then she'll know, you know, because of the circumstances, she'll know. But anyway, you know, terrible. Terrible, 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 terrible.
I have gratitude for it because it taught me, it was such a bonkers recreation of my relationship with my mother that it was very difficult to not accept at that point that, oh my God, you know, I mean, why would I get into this situation with this woman if there wasn't something very, very wrong, about my early years and my relationship with mom.
How did you have that insight? Because it's a pretty high order insight.
Yeah. I mean, it was just getting damaged again and again after these recreations. And then finally, I used a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy to get there finally in the end, going to war with that inner voice that just told me I was bad and I was worthless and I should be ashamed of myself. I just went to war with it and physically beat it down to the point where I just don't even hear it anymore.
You're using a little bit of language here and there of recovery. Did you do some Al-Anon or something in there?
I have never done Al-Anon, and now and no one has ever actually recommended that I do it. But it sounds like I need to do that, and
well,
it sounds like
I mean, you're already applying some of those same principles. I'm sure. I mean, the stuff that goes on at 12-step is a menu of things that are used in professionally managed therapies, also including CBT type stuff, and it'll be very familiar to you. But talk about the CBT. How was that done? Who did it? How long did you do it? What were the sort of the techniques so people understand what that is?
So this was following my really cruddy relationship with this therapist, and I went through a phase where I just was like, okay, no more therapy. Therapists are garbage. And thankfully, I've come out of that. I started to read books about CBT, joined a lot of, unstructured group therapies, and that was incredibly helpful. Currently, I'm doing EMDR, and I have found that to be maybe the most powerful tool for transformation that I have ever sought out.
Great.
Then I'm doing that and doing therapy about twice a week and still doing group therapy as well. It really is like, in order to recover from these things, it is just therapy, therapy, therapy.
Yeah. If you'd mangled your leg, have a couple years of therapy, that, daily therapy. We do it on legs and knees and things. We don't think anything of it. But brains somehow are supposed to need less.
Which is just ridiculous.
Ridiculous, yeah. So I think most people know what EMDR is these days, which is the eye movement desensitization therapy, going at sort of accessing parts of your brains that are essentially traumatized and walled off from the rest of your processes. And that's, the goal is ultimately to integrate all the parts of the brain. And are you focusing on specific traumas?
Yeah, I'm focusing on some very serious traumas that actually kind of rose up after I hit publish on the book. I actually sought out EMDR just because I was curious about it. Some friends of mine had great success with it, and I knew I had traumas, and I knew that I had dissociative symptoms that were kind of unexplainable.
Uh-huh.
Throughout the years, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was doing a lot of self-sabotage leading up to the publishing of my book, and I didn't feel comfortable with that. I felt like I should this is a goal of mine. I should be able to just work through this. And I was finding it incredibly difficult. And so
Can you tell us an specific example of what happened? The self-sabotage?
Yeah, I was very reticent to do any of the marketing for the book. Mm-hmm. I was very reticent to actually say, no, this is my story and that's okay. I was reticent to have anything good for myself.
Mm-hmm. So there were sort of inexplicable motivational states.
Yeah, inexplicable motivational states. I have always had difficulty with concentration and memory.
Mm-hmm.
I have periods of my childhood that I cannot remember.
Mm-hmm.
I have people from my childhood that I cannot remember. And, I never really paid attention to that because that was another level of trauma that I was going to get to once I got to all of this trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into EMDR and I took hold of those paddles and found out that my hippocampus is essentially just full of a horror movie of sexual abuse.
Oh, no. What, by whom?
Yes. An uncle.
Ooh.
Of mine. Yeah. Yeah. So, that's a whole new adventure. And of course I'm writing another book now. But yeah, I'm using EMDR now and it's been pretty, illuminating.
To me, somehow instinctively, I feel like that explains even a little more the messed up therapist relationship. Because when you've been groomed and sucked into something before, it's easier for somebody to groom you and suck you in.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
definitely.
Definitely.
So I'm not going to lay that one at the feet of your mom.
No, that is not her fault. Not at all. Yeah, but that has been quite the adventure. So that's what I'm kind of doing now, you know, navigating, pulling these memories up, finally processing these old traumas and moving forward.
Can you talk about that experience? Because I know lots of people that there's various kinds of ways. I'll just, you know, preface this by saying things that people experience when they get EMDR. Sometimes they have these really intense bodily-based experiences that they can't explain. They shake and they cry and they don't even know what's happening to them. Sometimes they go into sort of fugue states and can't come out, and all kinds of things that trauma does to us. What's been your experience?
That has been my experience, you know, from the very first session. My eyes literally won't move back and forth after a certain period of time because my body just doesn't want to feel these things. So my eyes literally stop working. So I actually have to use the vibrating paddles, which still works the bilateral stimulation, which makes EMDR work. I grab onto these paddles and I go back. I have very, very, my memories are extremely intact, but the feeling of the terror is there and it's immediate. And, you know, I drop into it immediately and start screaming. My very first experience with EMDR, I threw up. I was screaming and crying immediately and saw, you know, basically just one sexual assault. And, you know, each time I go back for it, I see another and another and another. And it is pretty terrifying because you will, you know, if you're in an extreme case like me, and I do believe that my case is kind of extreme, you are going to process that trauma immediately that's been in your hippocampus, and you're going to feel the terror, and you're going to feel the despair and the rage and all of those feelings immediately.
Well, correct. And then usually what happens, though, is you start seeing it, feeling it, so to speak, from a different place as time goes on. Have you had that experience yet?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, my therapist, she has me do, you know, mental exercises after these, you know, I find myself in these, traumatic incidents. Mm-hmm. She'll have me go back and rescue myself. Mm-hmm. And that'll be my thought experiment, my thought exercise for the next week or so. But I'll go back in and say, you know, let's rescue the baby. You know, let's take care of the baby. Get him out.
And so you start regulating more completely, but you also, because you grow so much, you start looking at it differently. You have different feelings about it. How long have you been doing this now?
I've only been doing this for a couple of months.
Okay, it'll start to you'll get this next piece shortly, which is like you there's no telling how you'll feel about your uncle as you grow and move and pull away from the immediacy of the trauma. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, some people oftentimes, believe it or not, not that he deserves any compassion, but they feel compassion, not identifying with the perpetrator, but kind of an understanding that this is also an extremely sick person. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it relieves you of some of the guilt and shame and all the things that you as kids, you feel responsible for the whole thing, right?
Yeah, I think I've carried that responsibility my whole life. Yeah. You know, I've carried all of these feelings of guilt and shame that are very external. And actually, I have nothing but gratitude for actually coming to EMDR and discovering all of these things, because I thought they were just parts of my personhood. I thought I literally could not focus on anything for more than 20 seconds at a time. Well, no, I've just been in a dissociative state for 40 years. And that's, you know, okay. I don't have some sort of, you know, a learning disability. It's nothing like that. I don't have to feel guilty or ashamed of myself at any time. I don't have to, you know, believe these limiting beliefs that I have, that I am not worthy of good things, that I don't deserve good things. I don't have to feel that anymore. That's all external.
What age did this horrible stuff start?
It started at, and it's still kind of, I'm still trying to put the story together. It started at 4 and I believe it ended at 8.
Oh my God. Is it possible the scapegoating, some of the behaviors that your parents were rejecting were related to that trauma that they didn't know?
I think so. I think that made me much more sensitive, mm-hmm, to
what my parents were doing and saying. And I remember being very attached to them, following them around, observing them, kind of therapizing them, and kind of forcing myself on them almost, in ways that I think my sister didn't, because I don't think she was experiencing, she might have, but I don't think she was experiencing abuse to that extent.
Oh, is this uncle abusing all the kids everywhere?
I have no clue.
Have you ever talked to your sister about it?
I have sort of briefly, you know, and I don't know if she has done this work herself. Obviously that's her journey. I can't force her to, you know, to be re-traumatized by these things. Oh, yeah. It's her choice to do this or not, but I have let her know. Yeah.
Whose brother was this?
This was no one's brother. This was the husband of an aunt.
Oh, does she know about this?
Yeah.
She knows.
No, he divorced out of the family about 30 years ago. He was very, quite obviously sociopathic. He engaged in all kinds of high risk behaviors, extraordinarily pathologically selfish. He had like a double family going.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was gone, kind of disowned his children. He's been a deadbeat dad for many, many years.
So it's their blessing.
Yeah. I mean, thank God.
Yes,
thank God
exactly. I'm sure he did some damage before he left, though. Awful. I hate to wish death on some people, but some people are – I do. God.
Some people are too gone, even though, I mean, it would be nice to come to a place with him of empathy.
It'd be rough. The dissociative symptoms, have those emerged in the EMDR?
You know, I mean, the dissociative symptoms have been something I've struggled with my whole life. I've always had night terrors. In fact, there's a very, very understandable illustration from my book. I'm hanging over a pit of snapping snakes.
Ugh.
From a tree limb, which, you know, I mean, obviously it makes a lot of sense in hindsight. But those were the kind of nightmares that I would have. And I never had good dreams. I always had nightmares. Always had emotion, big, big, powerful waves of emotion that were very uncontrollable. You know, I mean, I was attracted to those really bad guys, got abused a lot, kicked around a lot. Yeah, I mean, the symptoms and the signs were always there, but I really believe that the brain kind of blocks things out until you're capable of processing them.
Mm. Talk to me about the cycles you discuss in your book.
Yeah, the love bombing. This is a really unfortunate cycle that happens with narcissists, and you know what they do is they bomb you with love. This is called a love bombing phase, and you know, you can do no wrong and it's all romance and it's roses and everything is great and you're perfect and they make you feel so great about yourself. Until, you know, they have control over you and then they isolate you. You know, they take you away from anybody who could be like, hey, what's going on there? Maybe you should get away from him. They isolate you, then they devalue you. You know, suddenly nothing you do is okay and nothing you are is okay. And then they abandon you in order to feel...
Or they abuse you. Because it's the cycle of abuse, too. Same phenomena.
Yeah.
I mean, abuse. Yeah. I'm talking about, obviously, all kinds of abuse. You know, this is all the cycle of... This is all emotional abuse you're describing, but they can abuse in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big cause of you know... domestic abuse.
And then they come back with an idealized reunion. It's because I love you so much.
And then they're back. And then the cycle perpetuates itself. And each time you go through the cycle, you feel worse and worse and worse about yourself until, you know, you just don't feel like you're worth a damn.
Tell us more about the book. What are we going to learn reading the book?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't write this book for parents who are currently scapegoating their kids because I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell of reaching them in any way with the story through the eyes of their child. I think that's a very difficult thing to admit that you're doing. And I think it's very unconscious. Like I said, I don't think my parents had any clue that they were doing this. But I did write it for scapegoat kids to understand that, you know, if nothing else, you don't have to write. You don't have to necessarily do the things that I did. but everything is editable. You know, you can change that internal narrative. You can learn to love yourself. You can learn to kick people out of your life who do not respect your boundaries. All these things are learnable, and, you know, life is just one big adventure, and you can reinvent yourself.
You had an eating disorder in the middle of this too, yes?
Yeah.
Pretty common.
Yeah.
Did that need specific treatment?
I never sought treatment specifically for eating disorders. That was something that symptom began to sort of reduce and then die out,
mm-hmm.
based upon the other work that I was doing.
Right.
Yeah.
And if anyone's experiencing stuff like this, what would you advise them to do first?
I mean, the very first thing I'd advise you to do is get a very, very good talk therapist. And if you get the creeps from your therapist, obviously move on, find a new one. I think it's very important to shop around for a great therapist.
Yeah, you need referrals. But it's a hard thing because people don't know how to assess therapists. And oftentimes people want to leave when the going gets tough, which is exactly when they need to stay. Any advice on how to distinguish between just a bad fit and time to stick it out?
You know, I think that if there is a discomfort within you and you recognize that that discomfort comes from you being avoidant and fearing actually building a relationship of trust, I think you need to press through that. I think you need to push through that.
Right.
I think that's a good thing, that fear. I think any other kinds of fears take off. But I think that, you know, if you are basically just afraid of building trust and moving through this uncomfortable stage of, you know, of putting yourself out there, exposing yourself to a person who could potentially hurt you, but you know that it's the right thing to do and you got to push. I think you need to work through that.
Yeah, I agree. And now there's some pretty intense stories in this book, right? About your mom particularly.
Yeah.
Is she pissed?
She's extremely angry. Extremely angry, actually.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And any way to manage that, or?
I certainly hope so. You know, I was hoping that she understood that, you know, I mean, she was only this way because she grew up in an alcoholic family, and she has a lot of trauma, and I think she's an amazing person and I love her dearly, but I can't live a lie. I have to be honest. I think honesty is the only way that we stare down these, you know, multi-generational demons. And actually,
there's a lot of drawings in the book. Are they yours?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And are they from that time, or the drawings as you think about these particular things you're writing about?
It was essentially, you know, when I was writing the final version of the manuscript, images would sort of come to mind. Mm. And I mean, I'm not a writer, so it was always, you know, when I would get to the end of a chapter, I would always feel as if I left a little bit on the, you know, off the table. Just because, you know, I don't have so much of, you know, a facility with words, like a, you know, a wordsmith. So I would just sort of illustrate anything that was going on in my head, any kind of images that I saw, because I felt like it would sort of complement and really bring you to the feeling that I was feeling.
You say something interesting here. You say with mom, I go back into her childhood a lot to get distance and clarity, and you would do the same thing with your dad so you would feel close to him. Explain that.
Yeah. I've always felt it very, very difficult to attach to my father. He's very, very avoidant. That was his damage. Mm. You know, he spent, you know, so much time out in the woods or in the basement or just, you know, withholding.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was just beyond controlling, just so, so controlling, to the point where, I didn't feel like I could make any choices or decisions whatsoever without going to her and saying, well, what would your friends think of you if I made this choice?
Hmm. But going back to her childhood, what do you mean by that?
So, you know, going back to her childhood and going back to my father's childhood, you know, I used those exercises, and I don't necessarily know if this is exercise or if this is just obsession, to kind of understand where they came from. Because I think, you know, when you grow up in one of these families, you're very worried that you're internalizing, you know, these toxic things and that you're going to become them. And so, you know, I mean, I would go back and use these thought exercises to be like, okay, you know, if I know what this is, then maybe I can control it and maybe I can keep myself from becoming it.
Did you ever reveal to your parents or anybody what was happening to you with this uncle's?
No, I actually just found out about a month ago. My brain completely blocked out all of these memories because they were so, they're very violent. And there's a lot of violence there. There's, you know, lots of threats and lots of really horrifying material there. So my brain literally blocked it out.
Where he's saying, I'm going to kill your family if you tell anybody, that kind of stuff.
Yes. Yes.
Sheesh. Oh my God. It's just too much.
It's a lot. It's a lot, Dr. Drew.
It really is a lot.
I'm tired.
I get it. I'm looking at a picture of this Cindy doll. Tell me, can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that's sort of an imagining of what my mother's childhood was like. You know, just being dressed up and being, you know, sort of used as a prop. And, you know, this kind of Northeastern Irish Catholic alcoholic family, you know, that's has this presentation of, hey, we're together, but really everything is just falling to pieces on the inside. And so all of the commercial messaging that you see there would be from her parents, courtesy of her parents.
It's interesting, but one of the things you put in here is that she's only a girl. College isn't necessary, which is one of the horrible things perpetrated on her generation.
Yeah, horrifying.
Yeah.
You know, and her message to me was very much like, no, you're going to college. You're going to college. You're going to have a career. You know, you're going to put your intelligence to use and you're going to be independent, which is I'm so thankful for.
Yeah. So there were things to be things to be thankful for about her, even though she had serious issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
What else? Anything I've left out from the book? Murder, She Wrote. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that is a story about being watched by my paternal grandmother, who actually just passed away. She's an oddball, or was an oddball.
So that's the mother your mom had to put up with.
This would be the mother that my dad had.
Paternal. Okay, got it.
Yeah, paternal. Sorry.
Okay, sorry.
If I said much more. Paternal. Yeah, I think it was the one and only time that I was ever watched by her and, you know, babysat by her. And I was maybe 5 or 6, and I was so terrified to be around her that I just pretended to sleep for 4 or 5 hours while I was sick on her sofa. And it was just this really creepy memory I have of being at her home and just being incredibly uncomfortable and not wanting to be near her at all. She wasn't a bad person by any way, just cold, extraordinarily cold.
Was she an immigrant?
No, she wasn't.
And did she have any relation to that uncle?
She did not. Now, he's no biological relation to the family.
But I mean, wasn't staying at the house at the time or anything?
No, he would have been from my mother's side.
Oh, God, how awful. Well, how have you found putting all this out there?
It's been actually pretty dang fantastic.
Oh,
like
good.
The feedback that I've gotten from people has been has made it all worth it. Just so many people are like, this was my childhood.
Yeah.
You feel like I can feel these things. You make me feel like I can be honest and open about these things. And that's the one and only reason I did this.
And as you go towards the EMDR book, what do you want people to learn from that one?
Oh God. You know, I mean, this is very different. You know, my first book is made up of 20 years of journal entries, and this one I'll be writing as I experience it. So I think that it'll be even more emotionally raw and in the moment. And I just hope I don't make it too much for people because it's a lot. So I feel a little intimidated right now, but I know that it'll be really helpful.
I think it's a great thing to put out there because it gives people a sense of, you know, people are always wondering if they're doing enough, are they getting the right kind of work, or and when it comes to trauma therapy, you're doing the work and this is what the work looks like. And if they're not doing that work, that trauma is still sitting there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they need to kind of have this measuring stick to understand that while your situation may not be as intense and it may not be the same as yours, Aaron's, but it's going to be something. My thing, I kept dropping into Alan Shore calls traumatic dead spots, where I just mm-hmm. would lose track of time and space. Literally, I'd just be sort of out of it. And my therapist would all of a sudden go, okay, time's up. I'd be like, what happened? What just happened? It's almost like being in a hypnotic state. It's very strange. And those dead spots, and those have been described from trauma, they're dissociative spots. And it just shrunk and went away. But it was a source of immense anxiety and panic because my brain didn't want to go near that. Does that make sense to you, someone that was doing this work?
Oh my God, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So your brain is having other symptoms by virtue of not having some unpleasant symptom that trauma has left behind. And the other thing I had, and you tell me if you had some of this too, because it sounds like you were set up for this, I didn't have a good connection to my primary emotions. Feelings were sort of way off in the distance and hard to identify and weren't very rich. Did you have some of that stuff?
I did, yeah. Certain feelings were inaccessible. You know, my therapist would often say to me, "You have difficulty expressing the exact tone and tenor of your anger. It's always just rage,
mm-hmm.
and it's always just a flat explanation of rage."
Yeah.
And through EMDR, I've definitely been experiencing more levels of that.
Right. That's the trauma again, and it's red light, green light, and rage. Your brain doesn't like rage either because it feels murderous and destructive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you'll avoid that until you can't, and then boom, here it comes. How are you? Are you expressing anger now? Are you able to say "I'm angry about" and really express that to somebody?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But without being rageful. Without being rageful.
You know, I mean, and that's something that I'm still working through because this is all incredibly
yeah, it's new.
New. So you know, I kind of have to come to terms with, you know, moving through the dangerous part of that. I don't want to allow this rage to overtake me and become problematic.
Let's do one more round on destroyed relationships. Other than your paradigm, Tucker Max, what other sorts of relationships drama were you creating?
Yeah, I mean, I would always get into friendships with incredibly charismatic, sociopathic people.
Mm.
I remember once I was best friends with and living with a sex addict who mm-hmm. was just constantly destroying people's marriages.
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, I was her best buddy and I would just sort of, you know, hang out and be party to this and think, you know, why am I so drawn to this person?
Mm.
You know, she would just go out there and, you know, destroy a marriage and then destroy this person and destroy that person. And, you know, there were always these incredibly charismatic people around me who are incredibly controlling. And I was either, you know, depending on where I was in the cycle, I was either the best person ever and their best friend or, you know, the worst person ever.
Just so people understand, let's take that one, for instance. How does that play out? Where does that person end up?
You know, I mean, I think my tack has been always to get to the point where I've had enough and then hit bottom and move forward.
That's a word you end up with them. Because I'm thinking of some of the characters in Sex and the City and they were so sick. I kept telling everybody, these people do not end up in good places. And I wonder if you, without revealing too much, you know, divulging somebody's identity or something, can you tell people where some of these sociopaths end up? You know, these people that – you know, I think of Samantha and Sex and the City.
You know, it's crazy. I used to watch that show and think, she is so sick. There's something so wrong with this woman.
Yeah.
Why is she ever zero?
Yeah.
I don't
get that. Yeah. And the real person died of drug addiction. The actual woman that was fashioned after was a sex addict, drug addict who died of drug addiction.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you know where your sociopath ended up?
She, you know, every now and then I Google her. Mm-hmm. She is sadly a marriage and family therapist.
Oh, my God. Oh, my. Well, I mean, there is such a thing as recovery from that stuff. There is.
Hopefully,
indeed. I mean, if she's not going to SLA meetings and things, interesting. It's not, you know, sociopaths often don't get better, but they can. They can in the setting of addiction recovery. So, wow, you can pick them.
I know, right? Is my picker broken or what? I'm married.
It's not just broken, though. It's world class. I mean, you pick Tucker Max. You pick people that become professionals. Oh, my God. Professionals that are psychopaths. Woo!
My husband now is like the most amazing man, and our relationship was so uncomfortable for me.
Ah.
You know, because I kept sitting around waiting for him to turn into this monster, and it just never happened. And right. I'm like, when are you going to start lying? And he never, you know, and, you know, his love for me was always just so stable and so, you know, so healthy, and his boundaries were always so healthy. And, you know, I mean, it was so, so incredibly uncomfortable, but I'm really glad that I worked through that discomfort.
You're getting better with it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Did you experience it as boring or as smothering, or there's various different ways to get experienced?
No, I was terrified always.
Fear, you know, just fear.
When is this going to happen? Just straight up fear.
So catastrophizing.
And, yeah. Yeah. And I would try to leave him and break things off all the time.
Oh, so it's abandonment fear.
A fear of abandonment.
Do you think you had some borderline features yourself?
I mean, it's entirely possible.
Yeah, because the abandonment preoccupation and some of the rage stuff, that's sometimes called borderline rage. And I'm not saying you had that person. You clearly did not have that personality disorder. But when you have trauma, to have borderline stuff is pretty common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, when you're stressed out. I know I definitely have avoidance issues.
Yeah.
Deep avoidance issues.
Well, but it sounds like they're mostly – well, they're certainly manageable now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think diagnoses are useful, not terribly useful.
No. I 100% agree. 100%. I'm not saying that to put a pejorative at all. In fact, I'm trying to put it in a really inspiring spin, because a lot of people get labeled with diagnoses like that and do not do the work that you did to get through it. They just think, oh, I'm broken and that's it. I've got this diagnosis and forget it. But people with a true personality disorder sometimes aren't treatable. That's such a thing. But most of us just have traits. You know, we all have traits of, and we're all sort of these days all narcissistic of one type or another, and mm-hmm. a lot of trauma. And so naturally, there are those sorts of traits that are associated with those traumas.
Yeah, yeah, totally agree. Yeah. I think, you know, given the right stressors, we can all be everything.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's exactly right. Though to have a true disorder, you have to have a certain genetic makeup, we think, and although it's always a mix of, you know, the environment and the genes. Well, listen, congratulations on this. I mean, it's very inspiring what you've done and what you're doing, and I look forward to talking to you about the EMDR book, because I think that's going to be crucially important. This, I think, will help a lot of not just women, but men and women who feel the way you felt, which is so, 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 so common these days, when people are not given what they need in childhood. They're given the opposite of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you very much.
And
thank
it's called The Bad One, a memoir about growing up a goat and the scapegoating mechanism. Everybody, if you're engaged in it, please curtail it. Scapegoating is one of the worst things that humans do, and I understand it's a way of focusing on somebody else so you don't unleash your own aggression on one another. But how about you know, get more honest about what you're actually feeling and stop projecting it and acting it out on other people. All right, Aaron Tyler, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You got it. Well done.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.